Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
It's Tuesday, April 16th, 2002. My name is Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to another edition of the LaRouche Connection. Last Friday, Lyndon LaRouche gave an interview to Egyptian television, and the bulk of today's show will be taken up with that interview, which was scheduled to air this week on the popular Egyptian morning TV news show, Good Morning Egypt. Since Mr. LaRouche gave that interview just 4 days ago, many dramatic events have taken place in the Middle East, bringing that region and the world several steps closer to a major crisis, which could very well inflame the entire planet in war and an economic collapse far graver than anything that has been seen in modern history. Today, the major British daily newspapers, the London Independent and the London Times, have both published eyewitness reports from their own correspondents who have finally managed to enter the Palestinian refugee camp in Jenin. And what they report on the ground represents war crime atrocities carried out by the Israeli Defense Force on a scale that perhaps even goes beyond what Ariel Sharon did in 1982 in the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon at Sabra and Shatila. One observer in Jenin described it as another Catan massacre, referring to the World War II massacre in the Catan forest in Poland. Over the past days, Israeli tanks and bulldozers have moved into the narrow streets of the refugee camp in Jenin and have literally carried out what eyewitnesses are describing as massacres, indiscriminate killings of civilian residents of this refugee camp. And as a means of covering up for the mass carnage, bodies were piled up, and on top of the bodies, the rubble of the buildings that were knocked down by Israeli bulldozers was piled up. One reporter for the London Independent described his own experience encountering one of these human piles of rubble, these mass graves that have been buried over by upwards of one to two stories of crushed rock and cement and the other rubble of the buildings that had previously been in that area. The question now that's posed to President Bush in particular, but to all leaders of the world, is will they stand by in silent toleration of these new Nazi atrocities simply because this time around the Nazis happen to have surnames that are Jewish and happen to reside in Israel, in fact, are the people running the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Forces at the present moment? Only by taking up this literally Nazi imagery is it possible for people to understand the kinds of urgent measures that must be taken up by the President of the United States if he is to succeed in preventing the Middle East from becoming the flashpoint for the outbreak of a new global religious war that will soon engulf the entire planet in a kind of 30 years war of chaos, death, and destruction that will take several generations to bring to an end. Now, on Monday, the 15th of April, yesterday, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate for the 2004 elections, Lyndon LaRouche, issued an open call to President Bush, urging President Bush not to make the same mistakes that were made by the former president, Bill Clinton, who, despite the best of intentions to bring about a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, failed on a number of counts. And so LaRouche called on President Bush to study and understand, not in a flippant way, but in a careful way, the mistakes that were made by President Clinton in order to not repeat them and in order to take the kinds of steps that are absolutely essential to stop this Nazi mass murderer, Ariel Sharon, and the top leadership of the IDF from destroying any hopes for any peace in the Middle East for years, if not generations to come. LaRouche called on President Bush to step back, to look in the mirror, and to hold himself up to the constitutional responsibilities, the awesome responsibilities that come with the office of the President of the United States. We know that right now President Bush is being torn between a number of powerful, conflicting considerations. On the one hand, he does have a certain understanding that the situation in the Middle East has reached a breakpoint and that there must be some kind of a just and meaningful peace agreement reached between Israel and the Palestinians. As he himself has said, establishing two fully sovereign states living in peace side by side, Israel and Palestine. But to do that, Bush is going to have to step in and take very, very firm measures against the Nazi atrocities being carried out by the Israeli military under the orders of Ariel Sharon, based explicitly on the way that the Nazis themselves exterminated the Warsaw Ghetto uprising in the spring of 1943. One of the countervailing considerations weighing very heavily on President Bush right now is the fear that tackling Israel and thereby taking on the powerful Israeli lobby will result in his brother Jeb Bush losing the election in Florida, which comes up in November, his re-election campaign for governor, and this will lead to President Bush himself losing his re-election campaign in 2004. LaRouche urges President Bush to abandon all such petty political considerations. The President of the United States, during a period of grave crisis, has awesome responsibility to act on behalf of the principles of the general welfare and the common good that are embedded in the American Constitution. The office of the presidency is the highest authority under that Constitution, and the president must always act in those interests. In this particular case, it means that the United States must take the strongest possible measures to end the genocide in the Middle East and to impose a just and viable solution. The president has to be prepared to honestly call Ariel Sharon the Nazi that he is. He's got to be prepared, if necessary, to send in American and perhaps international peacekeepers. He's got to be prepared to sever all ties with Israel. And above all else, he has to be true to himself and to the responsibilities of the office of the presidency.
Mr. LaRouche, welcome and good morning, Egypt. First of all, I would like to know, how can you look at the American administration policy toward the Middle East crisis?
Well, of course, it's a tragic disaster at this point. It is not a simple disaster, because I believe that the President of the United States does not really know what he's doing. That is, he is so controlled by a small group of people, which it probably, except for Powell, are pretty much on the insane line we're hearing. And he's acting under tremendous pressure from a lobby inside the United States, which has made very clear to the President that if he does anything to offend Sharon, his brother will lose the election in Florida, and the Republican Party will lose posts all over the country. So we have a situation which is complicated by a president of limitations, that is, of conceptual limitations. He duly does not understand the situation. He probably despises Sharon personally, privately. But he's convinced that his political party and he depend upon not offending Sharon at this time. And so he's in an impossible, tragic situation. What is happening on the other side is the danger is we're now in a situation from a military standpoint where what Sharon is doing cannot work what the IDF is doing cannot work. You cannot fight war this way. Rabin understood that, Prime Minister Rabin. Rabin therefore made an agreement with Arafat and met with Arafat on what became known as the plan, the Oslo plan. Not because Rabin was liked Arabs, but because Rabin realized that they had to learn to live together at peace, because the alternative was something exactly like what is happening now in Palestine and Israel, this nightmare, which is actually a copy of the Nazi operation against the Warsaw Ghetto. Exactly, literally, no difference whatsoever. So it's an impossible situation. But this becomes then a trigger, as I think everybody in the region understands. This is a trigger for a wider war, because Israel cannot continue this internal operation within the bounds of Palestine and Israel at the present time. It will have to expand the war or collapse. The immediate targets are Syria through Lebanon, Iraq, possibly Iran. You have to remember that the Israeli command is not only Nazi-like in its thinking, not all Israelis, of course, but these people, but they also were operating on a conception in which they could do anything. So my concern is, in evaluating the situation, is the Europeans are resisting, not effectively, but they're resisting. The importance of their resistance is they're putting pressure on the United States. The United States alone might not be able to stop Israel from doing what it's doing. But if the United States were to come over to the side of what some of the Arab nations and the Europeans are saying, that combination of forces could stop this horror show. That's my hope.
Is that because of the hawks at the administration, all that policy going or running toward facing war, not only in the Middle East, but everywhere?
Well, you've got a real factor of insanity in the U.S. population, which is a result, in fact, of an ongoing worldwide depression. The United States, because of its political power, has been able to extract support, financial and other support, from other nations to create an appearance of stability in the U.S. economy, while in point of fact the economy is collapsing. What we have in the United States is a growing internal desperation, almost to the point of madness, of trying to deny the reality of this depression, to pretend that there is not a depression, there is not a worldwide crisis. Under this, you have, without adequate leadership, you can have even a major nation like the United States can become temporarily insane. And I think if you wanted to characterize the United States overall, you'd say it's in a state of insanity. It's not as bad as Washington. Washington is the maximum point of insanity. Outside of Washington, you'll find people are less insane than they are in the Washington Beltway area. But nonetheless, the insanity exists. My concern is how do I, as an American, turn this around inside the United States? Because I recognize the problem is I've got a situation in which the government is in effect, the Congress especially, is insane. And they're not likely to do anything sane. So how do I do that? How do I, by adding my efforts to what other people are doing around the world, bring about a situation in which we can turn the situation around? I would hope that we can possibly turn George Bush around, because George Bush is simply a man who was captured by his administration. Powell is an aperture to people who are listening to more reasonable ideas. But the larger number of people in the immediate circle of the president are pushing him in this direction, under domestic politics pressures, among other things. Can he be freed of these pressures long enough to see clearly what his problem is? He's now facing a great number of different problems, all great crises. He's not the kind of man who can intellectually handle a large number of crises simultaneously. Therefore, we can reduce his problems to one or two crucial problems on which he would concentrate his attention. Perhaps we might be able to turn him around too.
What about the public opinion, the American public? You just mentioned how the people act outside the Capitol. I need to know, how can you go through this, and how can you explain, as a Democrat, the Democratic Party has any role to play?
Well, the Democratic Party was pretty much taken over. The Democratic Party, frankly, would probably be worse than the Republican Party on Middle East questions because of the leadership and the financial control over it. Gore, for example. Gore would have been worse than Bush by far. Lieberman would be as bad as Bush. Gore is stupid, but Lieberman is clever and intelligent. but he's also bad. So a bad man who's an intelligent man and a stupid man or a sick man who's not so intelligent like Gore, it's not much of a choice. The problem is, in most countries, it's popular opinion. We all know this in all countries. One of the controlling factors in which we call democracy, it's not really democracy, it doesn't mean anything, but it's popular opinion. Swings in popular opinion can cause governments to do things that are insane or topple governments who are trying to do something sane. The problem is we don't have really a healthy society in the world today. The individual does not feel that they are a responsible member of society. They feel they are a victim of society who can protest, who are swung by moods. The United States is one of the worst. We are more controlled in the United States than in Europe or probably in most other nations of the world by manufactured, orchestrated public opinion through mass media. We're the greatest victims of it. This is a development which became worse over the past 35 years, since about 1965. Popular opinion swings dominate. Therefore, yes, it is a problem. And popular opinion in the United States, in my experience with this population, as with other ones, is that only the perception of a fundamental crisis, a fundamental economic and other crisis, will convince American opinion, popular opinion, to break out of the present mold. That is, if they perceive that the depression is the major issue, the economic depression, they're going to respond to the major issue, the depression. That will force a change in the agenda of thinking inside the United States. Now, that crisis is coming on fast. It's coming on around the world.
What about the November election? How can the American, Arab, and Muslim play a role? There are many motives for them to go and act. As you know, in your area, there are more than 750 originally Arab and Muslim, plus the people who supported them. And half of them at least have the right to elect.
Well, the problem is what I've been trying to do myself in this connection, I've been put into a unique situation personally, because I understand the situation. I understand the situation here. I understand the situation in the so-called Islamic countries, which are targeted. I have people I know in these countries. I understand them as much as any outsider would understand them. Therefore, I try to look at this from the top down. I understand the anger of the Palestinian. I understand the frustration of the Arab countries around there. I understand the fear and anxiety among the Islamic population of the world as a totality, and others as well. They tend to react with rage. If they believe there is no hope for a better policy from the United States and from Europe, they're going to become more and more angry, which is bad for these countries because they will tend to be more easily destabilized by their own accumulated rage. So what I try to do is to say to my friends abroad, Islamic countries, Arab countries, here's the way we must discuss the situation. Not you discuss the situation, not me discuss the situation. How should we discuss our common problem? We're trying to save civilization. Forget the so-called differences. We are trying to save civilization. You're capable of a rational solution. Well, let's concentrate on it. Then, if we do that, then the targeted populations of Americans, of Arab Americans and others, then have a sense that there's somebody is representing a position which corresponds to two things. They are Americans. They have thought of themselves as Americans. They didn't think of themselves as immigrants. They've been here for two, three generations or longer. They think of themselves as being Americans with families and connections abroad. And they've reacted as they supported the Bush campaign largely in the last election, as they thought that the Gore was worse than Bush on policies of their concern, and many of them mobilized to support the Bush election. Now they feel betrayed by Bush. So my sense is to encourage them, and I would hope that others would do the same, to think of themselves as their American citizens or American residents whose immediate personal interests are here, who have to find a way of expressing their views here, but on the same level that people abroad realize we have a common concern. This is not a question of one nation against another in principle. This is a question of an insane arrangement in the relations among states. We have a common problem. Let's reduce it to a common problem. Let's define it as a common solution. What do we propose as the alternative to this insanity? Let us unify our forces across borders around an idea of a solution. Let us try to mutually influence governments to come to an understanding of that solution. We have an economic crisis around the world, which is beyond belief, even without the military crisis. We have terrible instabilities. We have governments that are generally incompetent in many parts of the world. How do we save civilization, which is on the, and this problem of the Middle East is a marker, like a symptom of a disease. It's a marker of something that can destroy global civilization. How do we say, by cooperating with one another, that there is a hope, an alternative to this nonsense?
But as you know, there are now good boys and bad boys, whether you are with us or against us. This is their policy now.
That is
the official policy for the States.
That's a danger. It's a very dangerous enunciation of policy. But in the United States, one thing is good about it. The president can talk, but that doesn't mean the people agree. I don't think most people don't even understand this. Most people in the United States are obsessed by the financial and economic crisis that they face. If you forget the stock markets, forget the market reports, look at the number of bankruptcies, look at the people losing jobs, losing homes, look at the collapse of schools, the collapse of healthcare systems. Think of families, families which have concerns, which are family concerns, neighborhood concerns, community concerns. These are the conditions of life they face. What is being said in Washington is a diversion from the issues that concern them most. They would like to have national security. They were panicked by the stories told about September 11th, which are not true stories, by the way. But nonetheless, they were panicked by the fact. See what you saw on television in New York and what you saw in Washington on television, the stories that were told, the fears that were aroused. Yes, these divert. People do not want to face the fact of a depression. Therefore, they tend to cling to illusions, even delusions. Someone tells them it's going to be better. Oh, good, good. I'm glad to hear that news. But it's not. And therefore, the fact that somebody says that doesn't click. The thing to remember is the case of Adolf Hitler. Because we're in a situation like that of 1929-33, in which some people in England and the United States put Hitler into power in Germany with a coup d'etat. The danger in a situation like this is that somebody will make coups d'etats of wars, which suddenly moves the world into a new dimension, away from the real issues of life. Sometimes dictatorships arise because somebody is trying to divert attention from a real problem by a diversion, to mobilize people, defend the nation, that sort of thing. And so the danger is that what the president is saying could become reality in the minds of the population. But at this point, it is not.
But some starting realize that there are more spending here on arms projects.
Not really so much on arms. They say they're spending on arms, but that also is a farce. The administration has a lot of friends.
That's why I mentioned this, because I can remember what's going on in Alaska and the oil companies and, you know, the whole picture, how it looks.
Well, this is a strategic in one sense, but it's mostly economic. You have a great number of corporations in the United States that are going bankrupt.
Yes.
The Bush administration and some Republicans have a lot of money, a lot at stake in these companies. What is happening largely is not actually an arms buildup in a sense. They're replenishing some of the bombs they lost in Afghanistan, things like that. It would take a year, 2 years to build up a military capability of any significance. Say they want to go to Iraq. The best estimates the United States would take to do an intelligent operation against Iraq would require about 500,000 soldiers. They're not ready. They don't have the logistics. They don't have the capability. Not yet. But in the meantime, what they're spending money on is to bail out financial corporations, which happen to be the owners of arms industries. So this is not really an arms buildup in the sense of a Roosevelt-style preparation for a war. This is actually taking money to keep some of their friends in business. And in the oil business, you have two factors. You have a strategic issue, strategic oil. You have the Venezuela was just settled.
Today.
Yeah, right.
They worked hard on it.
Chavez went, and he went on time. He left at the time, appointed time. Now the oil crisis in Venezuela is now under control, at least apparently so. So the remains of the oil crisis state is now immediately Iraq. So, because you have to have a combination of states.
He has the Balkans too.
Exactly. And so other things can happen. But the oil business is also the people behind this. They're not really strategic thinkers. They're money thinkers. They are greedy money thinkers. And they will go for their financial interests first and national security interests second. They will always try to dignify their greed with the magic words of national security.
As usual, how the power work?
Often it does work that way. It is not how history works. But in the short run, I often compare the situation of the U.S. government today to that of Rome under Nero. Under Nero, this absolute insanity was running the Rome from the top down. People were killing each other.
Just burn the capital.
And like that situation. What we have is a tragedy, a true tragedy, which the controlling actors at the top in the United States are actually out of control. They're like characters in a Greek tragedy, headed toward the doom of their society. If they go on this way, they may destroy the world, but they will also destroy themselves. They don't think strategically. Look at Afghanistan, for example. 20 to 30,000 fighters in mountain warfare could pin down 250,000 American troops there almost indefinitely, as long as the arms flow in there. And the same thing that happened will happen. This is not the end of the Afghanistan war, it's the beginning, as the Soviets found out when they first went in there. These people don't think. Getting into an Afghanistan war was insane. Allowing the Middle East war to develop was insane. There is no intelligent motive in the sense of a real U.S. interest for such a thing to happen.
It will lead me to ask you again, indirect, again, how can you tell me about the American public opinion? In your opinion, how do you look toward that policy? One day, next month, next year, before ending the Bush term, or somehow they will gonna to wake up to tell him, do the American people have really, if you put and aside the power, the money, the companies, have the power, the enough power to tell them stop, enough is enough.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Implicitly, they do. If they understand that, but the American people are still largely captured by an illusion, a delusion that this economic system will somehow work out all right. They're sitting in a tragedy. I mean, think of every tragedy. They're classic Greek tragedies. Or any other tragedy. What you're looking at here, if you look at it from my standpoint, of a historian, philosopher, and so forth, what you see is, you see my nation as part of a civilization that is destroying itself. And the actors on stage are like the actors in any tragedy, who are all contributing in their own way to the doom of a civilization which has lost its grip on the reality they need to recognize. Can you say that? Well, in philosophy and history, we have a concept which is like that of Friedrich Schiller, the concept of the sublime. That, yes, a tragedy is caused by the people themselves. Not necessarily because they decided to do something badly, but because they allowed themselves to be stupid and contrary to their own interest. Therefore, How do you save them? Is it possible to save a nation which appears to be doomed from its own tragedy? Well, Schiller raises the questions in things like Jeanne d'Arc, for example, the play of Jeanne d'Arc, and other plays, that this concept of the sublime, the function of leadership, and it comes down often to individual leaders or small groups of leaders who have the imagination and the ability to introduce a new factor into the situation which can capture the imagination of the people and show them a bright light that leads out of the darkness. That's our only chance. And I sit here saying, I may be successful in changing the United States, I may be doomed, but I have to act for the success, even if I'm doomed. That's the way I must act. And I must act with other people around the world who are concerned about humanity, each concerned about their nation, but also about humanity. We must save humanity from this terrible danger. This is not a little problem. This is not a Middle East war. The Middle East war is a symptom of a decadence of civilization, which, unless stopped, could be the fuse that explodes the world into chaos.
Let me ask you a question. And do you believe President Bush will have the chance to gain another term, not like his dad, because there are kind of opinion running fast in the Arab world saying that he is doing this, he is making up wars to, because America like to be a cowboy to just to keep his post.
I don't think that Bush is really that important in terms of making policy in those terms. His father may have ideas, but his father was not a particularly intelligent man, particularly on domestic policy.
He's a CIA man.
Yeah, but that was nothing. I mean, some of the CIA men are the most stupid men I've ever met. They just happened to come from right school and so forth. Some of them were very intelligent, like a fellow I didn't disagree with too much, Colby. Colby was
You remember Wisner?
Yes. He was very clever, very clever fellow. But there's some of them are. But it's not just that. It's the problem is how is policy made? Now, in the United States, it's complicated, but it's also clear for us who know it, and there are very few of us here who know it, how the American constitutional system works. It's, the executive branch is very flexible institution. We can go through a terrible crisis without having to go to a dictatorship. In a parliamentary government, you will have a coup d'etat or a dictatorship when the parliament cannot solve an existential problem of the nation. In our system, the American system, we've been through terrible crises, but we have never lost our constitutional form of government. And that is because of the way the government is constituted by design, including the executive branch. Now, it's a complicated process. We have factions in the United States, two basic factions. One is mine, which is called the American intellectual tradition, which Franklin Roosevelt was also an expression of. There are others who share that. It may not be as conspicuous, but they're there. Then you have a banker group tied to the Southern Confederacy tradition, which is called the American Tory tradition. They are on top now. Our government is a complex of, as Egypt is too. Egypt's a large country in the sense of its ancient characteristics, and probably in Egypt you can understand the United States better than many other Arab countries because of that older system. You have an executive, deep professionals who do the military, other professionals. They're competent, they work. They're there as institutions whether the government changes or not. We have the same thing here. We have institutions which have formal institutions and just groups of people who are related to institutions. When the government wants to make a policy to make it work, it has to call on leadership. It generally invokes the people generally, but it also invokes the institutions and asks the institutions to mobilize around a policy. To do that, the institutions must discuss the policy among themselves, a dialogue among themselves, formal, informal dialogue. That is now going on. The way the president would... Now, I'm a different kind of person than Bush. I wouldn't be a president. Bush can never be a president. He can fill the office of president, but he can never really become a president. Because the president of the United States, if he's competent, must be responsive not to his personal or family interests. He must be constantly thinking about not only the nation, but the future of the nation, what the effects of decisions today will be on generations to come. as Eisenhower intervened in 1957. He acted like a president. He intervened and said no. Dulles would have said yes. Eisenhower said no. It was stopped. Suez War was stopped. A president must do that. The other alternative to having such a president is to have a group of institutions which are able to reach a sitting president and say, Mr. President, what you're doing is not going to work.
The advisor?
Not advisors. He has Powell is probably as a conduit for some of the better advisors that the president would have access to. But I think at present he's shut off from the institutions. The kind of dialogue that a president ought to have. I mean, the president ought not to be giving lectures to school children. It's not wrong to do that. But the president, in the time of crisis, must be talking to many people in the institutions, inside and outside of government. He must be focused on one or two questions on his agenda, leading questions. How should I think about this? Tell me what you think.
But it was always a question mark regarding who he appointed, such as Mr. Ashcroft.
Oh, he's not institutional. He comes from the back. He's a danger.
Yeah.
But there are
and they are talking yesterday regarding in case of Mr. Cheney, because of his health, so we're going to step down for the during the next election. He will choose John Ashcroft to be his vice president candidate.
That would be a disaster. Cheney actually is, while he's got many shortcomings, at least has a brain. I mean, you know, this is the problem. No, I mean institutions. I mean the kinds of people who are out there in permanent people in positions of government, permanent civil service, military, people outside government who were in government, who represent institutional forces. You know, the president would look for actually the intelligentsia, the American political intelligence intelligentsia, and meet with different currents among these to see if he could get something from these people, and then talk to foreign leaders directly on the same basis and say, look, this is secret, but let's discuss what I'm thinking, what I'm hearing, what do you think? And then you work out with people like your Secretary of State or someone else. You work out with foreign leaders, how are we going to solve this problem? And when you find out you have a basis for agreement on solving this problem, then you act officially. Because now you know that you have an open ear and mouth on the other side, and now you can bring it out into the public and make a policy.
Before we end this question, I would like to ask you, that kind of fear, around American Muslim and Arab community, especially here, because of Mr. Ashcroft, not him himself personally, but because of his policy and his assistant's policy. As you know, there are many of American Arab have been, through kind of security stuff. Many homes have been.
I know.
You know that it was like just a few weeks ago. It was like 12 or 13 houses.
I know. Well, how can you
tell those people now if you're talking to them directly through our program? Oh, what can you tell them? What
I tell them?
You have something to promise?
Yeah, I tell them what I tell you. Same thing.
Okay.
This is wrong. I'm fighting against this. This is wrong. This hatred is wrong. Is victimization. We don't want another McCarthyism in the United States. We don't want what has happened to the Japanese Americans again in the United States. We don't want racial or similar kinds of hatred inside the United States. This is wrong. Now, Ashcroft is, in my opinion, a stupid man with very, very strange, but he's not the problem. He's only one fool in that position. And there's a large apparatus in the Justice Department and other institutions which is perfectly capable of doing this kind of evil without needing an Ashcroft's thumb to do it. We have left over from past times, and this is the span of my lifetime and longer, we have institutions in and around the federal government which are controlled by Wall Street bankers and similar types who will do whatever they're told to do. And they've done it before, and they will do it again. The danger here is not Ashcroft. Ashcroft is a fool, he's a menace, he's disgusting. But he's not the problem. Look at the Supreme Court Justice Scalia, for example. More dangerous. Because he would back it up. And he's got maybe four people with him on the Supreme Court to support it. The danger is their institutions, which will operate as secret institutions, like a Gestapo. Again, and that's what happened here. It was a Gestapo-style operation. It was an extra-legal operation under a pretext. And that, so therefore, what do? I take a certain amount of personal risk in what I say internationally. I tell the truth. But somebody has to be seen standing up to tell the truth. Otherwise, the people who are victimized in that fashion or think they might be next are going to be frightened. And they're going to be rendered impotent, ineffective. They'll hide in their holes, hoping it's not them next, instead of being an influence. I have to stand up as an example of what the United States could be to people in the Islamic world, the Arab world, as well as among Israelis who are fighting against this fascism in Israel itself.
Let me tell you about something I just really recognized. Yesterday, outside the State Department, we were there. It was kind of groups from the African American community, from minorities, from Hispanic people, and I felt the anger within those people, and they talk out loudly, calling for Contarisa and Colin Powell and the other justice.
Oh, this was the protest group at the State Department?
Yeah, they have been now for 1 week daily. They go to State Department, they go every day mostly to the outside the Israeli embassy, and I believe tomorrow they will be at the B'nai B'rith out. And today also there are a visual candle on Key Bridge on Roslyn for the kids from schools. Yeah. And they, do you believe they are recognize how dangerous, I mean the administration, the African American finally moving, and they saw that what is going in the Middle East now, it's something similar than to the what happened to the South of Africa, plus the fear and the security against the people whose target, like Arab and Muslim. If there are kind of coalition.
Let's look at this on two levels. You have people who are professional agitation people who know how to make agitation. They're not all stupid. Sometimes they're right. But there's a certain theatrical aspect to what they do. And you have to look also at the depths of the same population, which you think are typified by the people in a demonstration. These may be people who've been at this demonstration, that demonstration, and so forth. They're put together. Now, that doesn't mean they're wrong. But that means one must not overestimate that. But what this does reflect, which you can find out in other ways, that the possibility of doing that, the sense of the fact that these people would do what they're doing, and some of them are probably honest people, but the fact they would do it mean that they know that out there in the American population generally, there is a general anxiety, not about what they, because they don't understand the issues in the Middle East, but an anxiety that they smell something which they know is dangerous to them. And they realize that this is the kind of thing that must be stopped because it's dangerous. It's like having a savage animal in your neighborhood. Not because you understand the animal or its intentions, you just don't want that thing loose in your neighborhood around your children. And people are reacting. And the people who go out and protest, some of them are understand what they're doing, some do not. But the protest is possible because behind the protest, there are many people who are not involved in the protest who would resonate somewhat sympathetically with that kind of process. In other words, it's not something that's come from the people as such, but it's people who realize what people are thinking out there, and they stage a demonstration, believing that possibly they can engage what they know exists in the population generally. And there is general deep anxiety in the population, as in Europe. You find something, look at Europe. Europeans are terrified of what this Middle East thing means, especially in terms of it goes to an Iraq war. They're terrified.
Look at Belgium and even in Germany. But let me tell you a story. One of our camera crew, he's an African-American. He was surprised and he was shocked when he telling me that story. He told me during the Eastern Day at the White House, and he used to go there every year to cover it, he found out that there are no African American kid, he can see it with the group from children they invited to come over to the White House. Can you look at the story, the symbol of that story? What
I know,
it can
because
tell?
In terms of my political activity, we have a very large base of, on the state level, of traditionally influential African American political leaders, state level professionals, so on. And in the past year or so, they've become highly demoralized, largely by the economic situation and by the fact that the Democratic Party is a failure from their standpoint. So you've got a demoralized population. This is the thing I have to deal with. How do I deal with an American population, which is the natural constituency for resisting what's happening, reversing it, who are demoralized? What you do in a situation like this is the only thing is just stand up. And that's what the significance of these fellows protesting at the State Department and so forth. Whatever is going on in their mind, the fact that somebody is standing up itself has a useful effect, because it may give somebody else the courage to stand up and actually say what they think. And it may give them the courage to feel they have the right to say what they want, what they think.
Do you believe that next November election will be a chance for those people to act?
No, it has to come before then. Our organizing around politics in the United States is always the most effective.
I'm
way.
Talking about the congressional
election. That's what I do.
Okay.
We're in this process, political process, not just much on the election basis, but on the general party basis. The parties in this country don't function. Democratic and Republican Party are drunk right now. There are many useful people in it. The problem is the parties don't function, therefore the people in it tend to be dragged down by the quality of the parties themselves as an organization. So therefore, I organize among these people. They know me. We talk to them. And I try to give leadership. And the key thing in any situation, the crisis situation, from my knowledge of history, is what the crucial factor is: leadership which addresses the crucial issues. And if you can do that, at least you're giving the people a reason for optimism. And if you can give them a reason for optimism, which is justified, they often will respond. And you have to be patient with the people.
If I'm American,
now,
forget about Virginia, because we are now talking to the people all around the states. Some, like in Michigan, there are about 1 million. Everywhere else, what is your advice to me to act immediately to reflect my negative opinion toward what's going on against
the minority? Well, I would always say the optimistic side is the most effective way. When people are being depressed, to try to depress them more doesn't work. It's negative. So you must not be essentially negative. You can say, this stinks, clear. This is wrong. I think you know what the anger is of people abroad, of what's happening from here. How is it, explain to me, how is it that a country with this history, the history of Franklin Roosevelt and so forth, could get to this state where they would allow this to go on? What is happening in your politics that allows you to tolerate this? Why don't you change your politics? And because the idea that there is an alternative is what's important. And when someone from
abroad, I'm asking about alternative.
Yeah, would you say
if there are only Democrat and Republican, where those people can go?
Well, that's the point. But we always fight inside these parties as well. It's the people of the people. The parties do not own the people. The majority of the people in the United States today who could vote do not like either party. They don't trust them. They might vote for one party, but only because they're voting against the other.
Exactly. This
they
is
don't
my point.
They don't believe they don't believe in it. So the problem is their pessimism, their lack of sense of organization, the lack of discussion of ideas, the news media, the entertainment media, which suppress all important ideas. We're in a cultural desert here. You must watch this crazy news media, entertainment media.
They're all biased. I mean,
it's ugly. And you can imagine the people which is spending so much of its leisure time entrapped with obsession with mass news media, the mass entertainment media. What's the moral effect on them? They're depressed. They're demoralized. They've lost their sense. Then you look at the schools. The educational system in our school system stinks. You would not graduate, a college graduate of today would not be qualified to graduate from a secondary school 25 years, 30 years ago. So you have an ignorant population, a population which used to be a producing society, it's now a consumer society. It doesn't produce anymore. We get from foreign countries some cheap labor. We extract credit from foreign countries to buy their goods of cheap labor. We live on credit. We don't produce.
Exactly.
That's our problem. We are actually a decadent society, but with a historical potential embedded in us from previous generations, which if we can awaken it, can do some very, because we are a power. If we decide to do something good as the United States, we can tilt the balance in the world to make something good happen. Like if the United States decided this mess in the Middle East is going to stop, it would stop. We have enough power to bring that about, not necessarily directly, but by our shifting our influence. And my concern is always to give a people a sense of optimism of what they can do with their lives. The problem is largely a moral one. The average American today does not think as they used to think 35 years ago. They've lost it. You have two generations who don't think the same way. The older generation would have thought in terms of coming generations. What am I doing for my family, my grandchildren generation? What am I doing for my nation? A person would sacrifice in order to give a better education for the children of a community. Would sacrifice to build this, build that, from which they would not directly benefit, to have something better for their community. Like large projects, like this thing in Egypt, this project of the new cities project for the imagine something which would take 5 to 10 years to become functional in every case.
Like Alexandria Library.
Yeah. So that it's necessary. So people in Egypt I've talked with many of them who were involved in this. Is an image of the future of Egypt, of the Nile system, of Africa, based on Egypt's traditional connection to Asia and to all of Africa. An image where people were willing to devote their lives and take pride as professor this or something that or a bureaucrat this, in a sense that they were devoting their life to this purpose, which is good, enjoyable work, in the sense it had a good purpose, but they were thinking about what kind of a future they're building. They could die with a smile on their face because they had given their life to something that meant something. Their life had not been wasted. In the Americans today, you don't have that sense. It still exists in every human being, potentially. A sense of, you say, what happens when you die? Well, I'm worried about what I get now. That's your American response. What I get next week. I'm not going to think about tomorrow. I don't want to think about the community. I don't want to think about the nation, the world. I want to think about what I'm getting next week. And therefore, a population which is indoctrinated with that, the pleasure-seeking population, like the corruption of ancient Rome under Nero and similar emperors, where they would march into the Colosseum for mass spectator sports, people killing each other, mass spectator sports.
Yeah.
And they were controlled by that. We have a similar phenomenon in the United States, a romantic phenomenon of a useless population, like Rome was living on grain taken from North Africa and from what is now called France, sitting there as parasites amid vast slavery and the most decadent and corrupt and disgusting mass of ruling strata you could imagine. And you have something which is not too much different.
At least there are kind of hope. If can I see, it's Berkeley, the World Seed student, but when I saw them over the TV 2 days ago and yesterday and all the time, I can imagine how the hope is anyhow nearby somewhere in America.
But it's
reminding me by Vietnam's and.
Well, what I'm saying, what I just said to you, I'm saying as an optimist. I'm optimistic about human beings, about the potential which lies in virtually every human being. And I think that with a certain amount of wisdom, we can devise ways to evoke that from them. But the first thing is what we have to be ourselves. To be an effective leader, you must be irreproachable in your commitment to that purpose. Because if you're false in any respect, the people will smell you out and they won't believe you.
Do you believe some people still running after you, trying to block you to access.
I probably
I just
have.
Remind Susan just told me regarding they tried to kill you. And,
several times. The U.S. government tried to kill me.
Do you have the feeling?
No,
the
I know.
Same
it.
Here.
I know it, but it's also more complicated because again, I'm an institutional person at this point. I'm an institution of the United States, and the institutions of the United States have been killed. They've been crushed and imprisoned and so forth and whatnot. But an institution has a certain, an institutional figure has a certain protection that the others don't. But they're afraid of me. The American Tory faction hates me and they're afraid of me. But they have a problem, is that what I represent in the United States does have a broad base, historical base, which is embedded in the people, in the culture. My friendship with countries in the Americas, in Central and South America, is well known. My friendship with countries such as Egypt, or my friendship with leading Russians today, my friendships in Europe, and so forth, my attachment to the cause, or almost hopeless cause, of sub-Saharan Africa is well known. So I'm an institutional figure. And many people in the United States respect me. They may not agree with me, but they respect me.
So we do, Mr. LaRoche.
As you go on, you know, life is short. What you accomplish with your life is what's really important. It can be shortened at any time. Don't worry about it. Just go on and do what you have to do. Be cautious. Don't be indiscreet. Don't be stupid. But don't gamble for perfect solutions. They don't exist.
Thank you, Mr. LaRoche, to have you here with us.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.